Hey, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Mission Matters. My name is Adam Torres, and if you'd like to apply to be a guest on the show, just head on over to missionmatters.com and click on Be Our Guest to Apply. All right, so today I have Matthew Ike on the line, and he is EVP and General Partner at U.S. Energy Development Corporation. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
All right, Matt, so a lot of people listen to this show, business owners, entrepreneurs, executives, investors, accredited investors, potential investors. A lot of people listen to this show because they're looking to get ideas and, you know, insights into different parts of the market. So excited to get into today's topic, how oil and gas exposure can create diversification in an investor's portfolio. We all know that diversification is a great strategy for many investors. And we're going to get into what that looks like. But before we do, we'll start this episode the way that we start them all, with our Mission Matters Minute. So, Matt, we at Mission Matters amplify stories for entrepreneurs, executives, and experts. That's our mission. Matt, what mission matters to you?
Well, great question to start any interview. We've focused quite a bit here at U.S. Energy on our purpose and our mission. And at the end of the day, it comes down to us wanting to be the most well-known and well-respected direct energy company in the country, and hopefully create kind of a beacon of light in the energy industry to help investors really see the path forward and how to participate in different energy investments across the spectrum, and hopefully really bring up the entire industry to being kind of that conceptual investment in energy to help, not just investors, but actually help this country in producing independence and creating a different pathway for the energy future. So we love what we do, and we're pretty excited about our mission.
Awesome. Love having mission-based entrepreneurs and executives on the line to share why they do what they do and, you know, how they're adding value in the marketplace. So great stuff there. So Matthew, I mean, to me, for the listeners that have been listening to this for a long time, they know I come from a finance background, worked many years in that space, almost 14. And, you know, one of the things that I always thought the energy and gas guys and just that market just in general, I always found it like really interesting. And part of that was because I didn't always know the most about it. I feel like a lot of the, during certain times of, let's just say our cycles, if it's in the media all over the place, you start hearing these new ideas, you start, you know, some people, you know, riding the wave of what they think may happen. And I don't think we always look at it as like, how can we use it to diversify long term, and where does it fit into our overall portfolios? But I guess just to get us kicked off here, like, where did this fascination with oil and gas, or like, how did you decide to get in the industry? Like, where did this all begin for Matthew?
So similar to you, I have a background in financial services. So I was an advisor in my prior life and had the pleasure of starting at the peak of the 90s and kind of the roaring marketplace in the tech bubble.
Wow, you just put money in and you just make it, right? It's like, oh, yeah, this is how it works.
So I started my career off and really loved being a financial advisor, and I had the opportunity to sell my practice very early on in my career. After about 4 years, I was able to monetize. I learned early on that I knew an awful lot about financial planning and not that much about money management. So I was always trying to hire the best money managers to partner with for my clients and our practice. And after I sold our practice, I had the opportunity of a lifetime where my beautiful wife's father owned a large real estate company and a small oil and gas company. And he asked me to come in and do a couple of guest lectures for his real estate company. And within about 6 months, he always joked that I was much like Kramer, where he never actually hired me, and I just started working there. So kind of the confluence of events where I had an opportunity in time, and I had this amazing mentor in my father-in-law and mother-in-law who happened to be in the real estate and oil and gas business, and this was my passion. And from that point in time, it's been almost 20 years, and I've literally loved every single day.
Wow, what an amazing story, and I get it. I'm like, because it's just, to me, it's really interesting industry overall. So I want to go further into this discussion, and I think maybe a good starting point would be, can you give us an overview of U.S. EDC, U.S. Energy Development Corporation? Tell us a little bit more about the company.
Yeah, so we're a second generation family energy company. So we incorporated in the 1980s as U.S. Energy Development Corporation, and we've seen every market cycle in the energy sector mm-hmm. since then. And there's been a lot. For those of you who don't follow the energy sector, it is a long-term cycle, bull and bear, but it's also short-term, an awful lot of volatility. So we have invested almost $2 billion in the energy space on behalf of us and our investors. We love to structure unique products. And the best way I like to describe our firm is kind of a marriage of two different things. One being experts in the energy space, but also being passionate and driven towards what investors want. And I don't want to say we created the concept or we borrowed it or stole it, but ultimately I look at ourselves almost like, you know, a vision of an Apple where they find the investor need and they marry it to what they do in technology. And for us, it's the same in the energy business. We look for both arbitrages from a risk and reward standpoint in the energy space and where we think we can make the most hay. And then we love tax law and finance almost to the point of an obsession. And so we try to find where those two things meet. And where we can find where the energy sector can provide something and the tax law can marry that with greater opportunities, we structure unique funds up and down the spectrum to take advantage of those two things, kind of the risk reward that we see alongside of the different tax arbitrages. So we really look at ourselves as a financial planning company that happens to do a really good job in the energy space. And we really only want us clients who need those arbitrages to utilize our tools. And oftentimes other companies in the space will have other mediums that might help an investor who's in a different situation better. And really we look at ourselves as specialists that help people create all these unique arbitrages. And when we can't do it, we don't. So oftentimes investors have needs, but we can't deliver, or the energy space can't deliver the returns or the risk or the profile that they want, so we won't structure the product. So it's kind of be the confluence of the two. And I know it sounds odd to say that as an energy company that operates, you know, thousands of wells in 13 states, and most people in the energy space know us as an operator, but the reality is we're really an investment company that happens to do oil and gas operations and larger energy operations in general.
So you said, you know, $2 billion, you know, give or take a little bit, $2 billion, give or take a couple of pennies either way. What I'm just trying to wrap my head around this, like, because I know you've been in this business a long time now. I mean, going on 2 decades at least, for yourself alone. That being said, like, how many wells does that look like? That's a big operation.
Yes,
to the well, but like, like, yeah, how many? Like, can you give me a feel of like what that looks like.
So I'll kind of give you on an annualized basis. So we're somewhere in the $100 million to $300 million of new CapEx spending. You know, your average well will be $7 to $10 million of cost. So you're adding 10 to 20 horizontal wells. In the olden days, that would be thousands and thousands of, you know, little vertical wells. But, you know, the average well cost today is let's just call it $7 to $10 million. Mm-hmm. So for every 100 million, it's 10 wells. So you're really just drilling 20 to 40 wells a year of inventory. Now, we do a lot of joint venture work, so it multiplies that because you're selling down your interest in only 30%. But on a gross basis, you'd be surprised at how much capital goes into these 2-mile wells now.
Amazing. And so not, of course, for everybody listening, like you want to consult your advisor and you want to make sure that, you know, whenever you're investing to make sure to do your due diligence. But so I'm not asking this in the sense of a loaded question, Matthew, but getting further into the discussion, when we think about diversification and people are thinking about how oil and gas may fit into a portfolio, like where should they start doing their due diligence or what should their thought process be to dip their toe in the water? Or possibly if they haven't considered oil and gas really as a part of their portfolio.
Yeah, so I'll even bring it up to energy beyond just oil and gas, but it is I'm going to have a lens that's biased towards my history. So I'm going to try to bring that out a little bit, bring this up from 30,000 to 100,000 feet, because there's a lot of ways to invest in the energy space. And the markets shift constantly what's in and out of favor, whether it's public access to things like master limited partnerships or publicly traded stocks it's on the private side of different investment funds that take advantage of different tax law, like drilling funds are probably the most common. From our perspective, again, we kind of really look at the world as the investment tools and then the assets underneath them. So more so than even diversification in and of itself, we look at things more as how to create, you know, these tax planning opportunities and then the different parts of the industry that work within those tax planning opportunities. In addition to just pure saying, I want to put 3% of my portfolio in energy or direct energy. And I'm going to give you an example of what I mean by that is, you know, there are a lot of ways of investing in the oil and gas sector. But for a client who sells a piece of real estate and has a potential for a 1031 exchange, they might be looking at a multitude of tax options to maximize their returns. And so for that investor, they may be looking at things like 1031 exchanges in oil and gas, which I don't know if the world knows that oil and gas properties are like-kind exchanges. They are real property. So someone selling real estate could actually exchange into mineral rights or working interest in oil and gas. And that might be one medium to diversify that exchange that used to be 100% real estate to maybe be 20% energy now, right? So when you kind of talk about the allocation, that tax law allows you to marry that opportunity. Or that client might want to use something like an opportunity zone or maybe a drilling fund based on what state they live in, what different tax laws, what liquidity they want, what taxation deferral they want. So we don't really look at the world as just saying diversification. We look at it and say, okay, for this individual with this situation, maybe one of these three tools is the most appropriate, a 1031, an opportunity zone, or a drilling fund. And for a completely different client who is retired and has a ton of income and they're looking for a passive loss, they might use a completely different tool in the energy space. So the way that we look at the world is, hey, there's all these different opportunities. Let's see what oil and gas, or I'll go beyond oil and gas, energy in general, can offer from an investment standpoint and how different subsets of investors can take advantage of those. So just to go on a high level real quick as an example, you know, corporations, unlike individuals, don't care about passive or active losses. It, from a tax code perspective, it doesn't matter. So for them, sometimes a renewable investment with tax credits that you and I couldn't use individually work really well for a corporation. So sometimes a renewable investment might meet their corporate thesis as well as give them a better tax arbitrage, whereas you and I might not benefit because we don't need that type of deduction and can't use it. A passive credit, a corporation can. So we really look at the end solution as, hey, how do we get the greatest risk advantage return? And then obviously, how much do you keep the most amount of money in your pocket and not pay it in taxes? Designs all the investment tools. And then every client should be looking at the whole array of them and saying, okay, where does this fit within my financial plan?
That's great. And so taking it a step further there, from your vantage point, like what's interesting in the energy market right now? Like what are you seeing today where you see that there may be some opportunity there?
Yeah, so most interesting thing for me is that whatever was true is not true going forward almost every market cycle. Things shift constantly, and capital flows tend to shift where the opportunities are. And one of the biggest risks in oil and gas used to be historically when things go well, too much capital comes in the space, and then it floods the market and diminishes the opportunity. So oftentimes it's really being where they're not that creates the greatest risk-adjusted return in the energy space, right? You know, thematically and very difficultly, right now it's very hard to do well in renewables because there's so much money chasing it from the ESG movement, and there's so much institutional money that's willing to lose money on it. It makes it very difficult on a large scale to do it well. It doesn't mean it's not great for the environment. It doesn't mean it's not fantastic. But on a pure monetary standpoint, it makes it very difficult unless you're focusing really small scale to have underlying economics with it, right? So it's out of favor for us, even though thematically it's in favor, it's hard to do right now. And the same thing might be with mineral rights were for years for us very difficult to purchase because they didn't generate UBTI, which is just a tax code that nobody needs to know. But pensions and endowments owned massive amounts of them. Well, now that kind of that ESG, environmental social governance, has pushed a lot of them to divest of it, there's a ton of it in the marketplace at phenomenal yields and returns. So the tax law was always there. So now you can do 1031s where you weren't able to do them for 10 years. And at a time when price in oil is really profitable. So these things ebb and flow. And for us, it's looking forward on where is that opportunity set and how do we take advantage of that arbitrage. And to tell you the one I'm most excited about, it's probably the one that the people know the least about and for me is the greatest tax code ever written, and that's the opportunity zones. Mm-hmm. So just to be macro, the irony of passing this tax law that allows people to basically create mega Roths, right? Basically, you take a capital gain, you put it in, you defer your taxes for a couple of years. But what it really does is if you hold it for 10 years, it turns all your money into tax-free money. When you overlay that with the census tracts that the governors chose in different states, it happens to be over the best reserves of oil and gas in the U.S. The Permian Basin, Eagle Ford, you name it, all have massive trillions of dollars of investments available in the oil and gas sector in opportunity zones, and no one knows about it. So I get more excited when those two things overlap because nobody even thinks about it. Everyone thinks it's a real estate investment. No, it's an any investment, and it just so happens that instead of chasing, you know, trying to find a diamond in the rough, it's unlimited inventory, and no one's competing for it. So that's the kind of stuff I love.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Whenever I hear opportunity zone, all I hear people talking about is real estate.
Yeah, I'm going to say this for your listeners.
Yeah, say that again because that's why I had to bring it up because I'm like, you know what? Now that you said that, that's the only thing when I hear people talk about is real estate typically. Go ahead.
I just want your listeners to know, forget U.S. Energy for 2 seconds. Opportunity zone tax law is the single greatest tax arbitrage in the history of the United States. It allows wealthy investors to create mega Roths. You don't have to just put real estate. It can be, yes, oil and gas. And our industry happens to work insanely well under the tax law. And again, no one knows it. But it can be your own business. It can be other businesses. The tax law allows you, as long as you're willing to invest over 10 years in that area, all of the future growth is tax-free between 10 years and 2046. It is the single greatest tax law ever. And I think people miss it because they just think of it as real estate and they're worried that it's in urban centers that have to gentrify and are they going to find the diamond in the rough? No, it's a much, much bigger architect of an investment tax law that applies to many other sectors. Now, selfishly, it applies phenomenally well to us and we've taken advantage of it like no other company in the U.S. And the beauty for us is in oil and gas, you get this really high what's called IRR. That means the time value of money because you get money back so quickly in a well that you're constantly reinvesting it in the up zone and growing the assets. Oil and gas doesn't always have the highest ROI, which is return on investment, because it might take, you know, 10 years to get all the production out of a well. But if you're getting most of it in the first 2 years and then you're reinvesting it over and over and over again in an up zone, it just compounds the wealth like any other tax-free investment at an exponential rate. So it works exceptionally well in our industry, and sometimes it's exceptionally hard in real estate because in real estate, you can't generate short-term income based on the what are called substantial improvement or original use laws. But in oil and gas, you can. So again, really unique. And I just keep the macro statement in your mind. If you're not using opportunity zones, you are missing the greatest tax law in the history of the United States.
Yeah, awesome. So what type of partners or investors do you typically work with at US EDC? Like, who's normally a good fit to connect with your company?
So our primary investment world is actually advisors, RIAs, investment houses. We love the educated consumer because we don't want to be an end solution for every client. So at the end of the day, it's accredited investors who invest with us. You know, high net worth investors who want invest in the sector and want all these tax arbitrages. But at the end of the day, our real investment and our partners are all the advisors in the U.S. because they know when and how to use us. We're an arrow in their quiver, right? We're one phenomenally useful tool in a much bigger arsenal, right? We work really well in estate planning. We work really well in gifting and taxation and all these different nuances. And so our partner and our job is to educate them under all the different risk returns and tax arbitrages that are out there and let them determine with their clients where it best fits in their portfolio. And we'd rather have only clients who get the maximum value invest with us for each one of those mediums, right? Versus just saying we want every accredited investor. We don't. We raise so much money that at the end of the day, we're looking to find the best investors, not just bring in more capital. And most years we have to close our funds early anyways. So we really just want the investor who gets the best benefit to work with us. And that's usually done through an educated advisor who really understands where to use that in their portfolio.
Fantastic. And Matt, so if somebody is looking to connect and they want to learn more, what's the best place for them to do that?
They can start at our website, usedc.com. And start there. They can start with their financial advisor who can call us as well. Now, not every financial advisor has the legal ability to work with every investment house, but we'll still educate them on the industry and on us. We're kind of agnostic. We want to lift the whole industry up, not just U.S. energy. So we really see it as success when everyone does well. But yeah, they can come to us directly. And then hopefully there's someone on the backside. Oftentimes if they just use a CPA, that also works for us. We can work with their CPA and make sure that there's a benefit to them and they're not improperly trying to utilize the tax code. So we just want to verify that they get the maximum benefits.
Fantastic. Well, Matt, really been a pleasure having you on the show today and learning more about your background and, you know, your work in oil and gas and energy, and also learn more about really how investors can start thinking about and reframing their thought process around energy and where it fits in their portfolio. And speaking to the audience and the listeners, if this is your first time with Mission Matters, we're a platform that's all about bringing on entrepreneurs, executives, and experts and having them share, you know, why do they do what they do? Like how are they bringing value to the market and what gets them excited and energized to go out there and to make a difference? If that's the type of content that you're into or if that sounds interesting or exciting to you, we definitely welcome you to hit that subscribe button because we have many more mission-based individuals coming up on the line and we don't want you to miss a thing. And Matthew, really, it has been a pleasure having you on. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, of course. Do you mind if I make one quick comment kind of in the end there on the energy space?
Oh,
is it okay?
It.
Or do we have
do
a
it.
Moment?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to make this statement for everyone. I really believe we're in a phenomenal part of the bull market, the bottom of a super cycle in the energy space. And I'm not just saying that because of the inflationary pressures or what's happening in Ukraine or the current price increases in oil and natural gas. Those short-term effects really are blurring out the long-term part of the cycle that we're in. So from me as a macro investor, I look at the sector and I know there's a lot of push on, like I talked about before, the ESG movement. But when you really realize that even under the most aggressive carbon neutral plans, a gross neutral is not a net neutral. It's still a 30% increase in consumption in oil over the next 30 years. And it's a much larger increase in natural gas usage. Even under the most aggressive conversion concepts of renewables. And I really want people to know that from a supply and demand imbalance,
in my 20 plus years, the last three and really probably the next 10 are the best time we've ever seen in the space. So as an investor, find a way to participate. And really, if you really believe in ESG and in activism, investing in oil and gas is being active, because you're choosing to invest in the U.S. instead of somewhere, instead of investing and avoiding it and giving all the power to Russia and Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and the worst actors of the world, like Iran, you're investing somewhere that actually is making a difference and doing it in the most environmentally sound way. So my two cents is find a way to invest. Even if you don't believe in its future, it is the best time and it is the most sensible and accountable way for doing it. So that's my soapbox. I'll get off it. I just thought it was an important point.
Yeah, awesome. And we will end it on that. And Matthew, really been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.